Welcome to the Ohana Life Podcast. I created this podcast to provide important information that would empower you on this journey of life that we are all in together. I bring two people that I found extremely helpful to me or are an inspiration in some unique way. I try to combine my knowledge and questioning with the way they serve society in their distinct roles. It takes a team, a holistic family of support to feel whole in our lives. I wanted to give them a larger voice to explain what they do and why. I'm a very curious person and like to learn, observe, critically think, and engage. The best knowledge I receive are the ideas that I can use immediately, and I hope you find that with these episodes. I personally am a movement educator, and each student is my mirror. They teach me about how I use words and how their bodies react to certain scenarios in a playful, safe space. I like to make sure they feel grounded and ready for what life has to offer. Life can be hard, and we can never know what to expect day to day, and I like to prepare them for real life scenarios. Students show me where my level of compassion is at as I watch stories of their lives unfold with each and every movement. It is a play and a delicate dance of intuition as we work together, so they get the most out of each hour we are together. I want to extend that into these one-hour podcast episodes and have some ideas of other ways life can be beautiful and you can shine in all scenarios, living life with grace and tenderness. These episodes do take time to create, finding the right person, hoping they say yes, sorting, researching, and gathering the topics and questions I want to ask, getting it published, and then releasing it in hopes that you are inspired after a short hour's time. I hope that you share it with others and research what these leaders provide and can find hope in difficult situations, whether they be movement, daily interactions, past dilemmas, and future ones to come. In this episode, I had the honor of interviewing Lama Willa, a teacher at the Wonderwell Buddhist Center in Springfield, New Hampshire. I had visited there with my husband years ago and loved the center, so it's always been in the back of my mind. Lama Willa just recently released a book, and a good friend of mine gifted a copy to me. Reading it made me so happy as it gives deeper meaning to what yoga is, other than most books which can gloss over the deeper intent. Yoga is about living in awareness at all times. She does a great job of detailing that out with many other concepts more developed for an inquiring mind. I have always wanted to have a Buddhist teacher on the podcast for a while now, someone I could ask questions that had direct teachers in the lineage. She was very gracious to say yes to this interview. She has much rich history in traveling with monks, being in the mountains, her journey of self-discovery, and paying it forward with her teachings. We spoke about who Buddha is, initial ideas in the teachings of Buddhism, mindfulness, pathways of habits, somatic awareness, and meditation. I will include links to her book, the website, to the center, her upcoming workshops, and all about her education in the episode notes. I do hope you enjoy this discussion as much as I did. And I did want to note that it was quite windy while recording, so the background has a nice howling of springtime in New Hampshire. So I hope you enjoy that. Thank you. I love you all. Enjoy. So welcome, Lama Willa. It's so nice to have you here today.
Thank you, Lisa. It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
This is really special for me because this is our second season of the podcast, and we have not had someone as, you know, high level in terms of yoga here and the teachings of Buddhism and things like that. So I feel like this is like an honor for me and for our the people listening to get more of a sense of what is out there. And plus you released a book, which we'll kind of link in the show notes that I've been reading. I'm more than halfway through, which is exciting. It takes me a long time to read. And I wanted to kind of ask you questions based on this. So do you want to just tell people a little bit about yourself so they have an idea of who you are and maybe a little bit of your history? I know there's a lot in the book, but maybe just something that you want to start with.
Yeah, identity is a funny thing, isn't it? Especially if you're a practicing Buddhist, where we have this notion of no self, and it really is true. It's like a fluid thing. So, lately I've been thinking of myself as just in the most broadest sense, an author and a teacher. And I'm a teacher primarily in the Buddhist tradition, but in some ways, even it's hard to it's hard to fully embrace that identity, because even a word like Buddhist or Buddhism is so confining and constraining. Yes, but I'm a teacher, and I often teach retreat, guide people in the practice of deep retreat, meditation retreats that have some dimension of yoga or body work connected to them.
And I met you, so you run a retreat center in Springfield, New Hampshire. Is that where it is, Springfield?
It is right. Yes, yeah. Springfield, New Hampshire.
And
yep.
It's called Wonderwell, and my husband and I have been there a couple times where we met you, and it was pretty great. Our children were pretty small at the time, so we haven't gone as much as we wanted to, but it felt like such a beautiful way for us to connect, but also to be close enough to the kids. You know, I think it's an hour from here, but far enough away where we felt like it was such a beautiful event, actually. Because I think one of the events we did was on maybe New Year's Eve. Did you do something on New Year's Eve? I feel like it was setting vows for the new year or something.
Yes, we may have done that. We don't always do it on New Year's Eve, but every new year, somewhere around the first, we do give, we do traditionally, and in our organization, we offer the traditional vows of refuge and the Bodhisattva vow. And lately we've been adding to that the Ecosattva vow, the vow to be of service and to protect and be in relationship with the earth and its ecosystems,
which
as
is
part of the Bodhisattva.
So important that more now, I think it's always important, but it's almost critical now, I believe.
Yes.
So I think it's wonderful that you add that as a part of it, because some of us do appreciate Mother Earth all the time, but when it starts to get to that critical point of, you know, we need better soil, we need to really think about every single action more, it can get, you know, it needs to be in the forefront of our mind as a vow.
Yes.
As thing that we appreciate.
Mm-hmm. As a commitment, and also the framing of this, not so much as a an engineering problem solving thing, but rather as an ethical issue and as an existential issue. We have this term that we all use, climate change, but the issue is so much bigger than climate. It's about who we are, mm-hmm. and what our relationship is now and is going to be in the future with our world. It's not to say that it's about climate is so limiting, mm-hmm. when it's really about, and even just reframing it as it's so important right now what we do and doing things as quickly as possible, as this idea of the urgent action. It's true. We need to do things, but we also need to change how we are and how we live and who we are in relationship to the planet. So, just appreciating that. And I think that contemplative practice and yoga practice has a lot to do with being rather than doing, changing our way of being. So I think there's a real possibility for a conversation between the contemplative world and the world of ecological activism. Mm. Yeah, I don't know if that's where you were going with this interview, but I just didn't want to say that.
I love it to go where it needs to go.
It just came up.
Yeah, I know. I follow Sadhguru, who is more under the Kriya Yoga. Do you follow him?
Yeah, I've heard of him. I don't know. I wouldn't say I follow his teachings, but I've heard of him, and he sounds like a very fascinating and
He's very fascinating, and he follows kind of the Kriya Yoga lineage, but he has this initiative right now on Save the Soil, because when he first decided that school wasn't for him and this world is just a play and he was having a hard time fitting in, he was given a plot of land. I'm trying to remember how he got this land, and they said, oh, we don't need it. It has all these weeds. And we can't do anything with it anyway. And he was able to figure out a way to grow a certain crop or a certain thing. I don't know if it was a flower or food, where the weeds were like the way to keep the soil moist, right? And I think that was his start in all this. But now he's saying, you know, in 20 years, if we don't have enough topsoil, we can't grow anything. So he's really has this initiative of like save the soil and really get, we need, you know, feet of soil added back into this planet. So anyway, that's his big initiative right now, which I think is beautiful.
Oh, very nice direction. That's great to hear.
Yes. So yeah. That's your direction as well.
Yes.
You match that. So, okay, let's start pretty basic. For someone who doesn't even know anything about Buddhism. So I study more like I know more of the Tibetan monks. Like I went to India and stayed at their monastery, and I have, you know, a lot of relationship with them, but they can't teach me much because they don't speak English. And I more studied a lot of the yoga texts and methodology that is more like Hinduism. So I have more background on that. And so maybe we can describe like when did Buddha find enlightenment? Who is Buddha? You know, maybe just a little history on why Buddhism is Buddhism.
Okay.
I hear the wind just whipping.
It's a little, yeah. Is it okay? Or should we?
Oh yeah. No, it sounds scary and delightful all in one.
It's very windy here right now. So it's howling through the house, through the doors. This is how it happens. So the Buddha was a human being like you and me who lived 2,500 years ago, 2,600 years ago in northern India. And he, like some percentage of the people in his day, in India, he was a spiritual seeker, and he according to the stories about the Buddha's life, he was a prince. So he lived a very lavish life in the early part of his life, and then he encountered some experiences. Going outside the walls of his palace, he encountered death, he encountered aging, he encountered birth, and he encountered illness, seeing people that were ill for the first time. And he developed a sense of renunciation for his lavish lifestyle and set out on a journey to figure out what is it, this thing that we call suffering, and this thing that he was witnessing, the human sufferings, and how do we cope with that? That became his key existential question. How do I cope with human suffering? How do we all cope with human suffering? And the story goes that he wandered the Indian countryside. He got teachings from other wandering ascetics and yogis, and he eventually ended up on the banks of a river and meditated on that river for 6 years, looking into the causes of suffering. And at the end of that 6 years, he sat under a Bodhi tree and and practiced meditation until midnight. And at midnight, the story goes, he had an awakening, and he called that awakening nirvana. And nirvana means something like a blowing out of grasping and craving, which he later explained as a blowing out of grasping and craving. But at first, he didn't have the words for how to describe what he had experienced. And I think maybe if, you know, if you're meditators out there listening to this, you can relate to that. When we meditate, we have experiences that are very hard to put into words. And so he had very challenged to put into words what he had experienced, this nirvana, this blowing out. So he wandered around in silence for 2 weeks, and then he realized that he needed to share what he knew with others and needed to begin to try to put it into words for the benefit of others. You know, a very compassionate response. You have an insight, then how do you share it with the world? How do you pay forward what you've experienced? So he started sharing it in the form of teaching. And his, the first teaching he gave was called the Four Noble Truths. And actually that is a teaching on the origin of suffering and the reasons for human suffering. And in that teaching, he also proposed that human suffering can be addressed, but the causes for that suffering have to be addressed within the human heart. That changing the conditions in the outside world is not enough to address suffering. We have to work with the conditions within. And that really set the tone for the rest of his teachings that we call now Buddhism, the body of teachings that started to have a label called Buddhism. And so that's a little bit about Buddhism. And sometimes, you know, people think Buddhism is pessimistic because it's concerned with suffering. But actually, Buddhism is very optimistic in its tone and its orientation, because it's a tradition that that wants to find the causes of human happiness, and that helps us find the causes of human happiness, and establish that the seeds for that, and to learn how to work with the seeds of suffering, and how to be present in a compassionate, kind, and liberating way with our own feelings of suffering.
It's something that I don't think anyone I know thinks that they're not suffering in some way, right? So it is good to address that suffering, and everyone's suffering the same in that they're all suffering, but differently. Like, they all think their suffering is maybe a bigger hierarchy, but we would never trade. If we had to put in a hat, right? Whether we would want to be with somebody else, we probably wouldn't change our lives the way they are. Usually, I think there's some cases where someone might definitely want to. But I think that because people suffer, it's this is where the conditions of abuse, right? Alcohol abuse, food abuse, drug abuse starts to come in, right? To try to counteract what they feel. And we're just, I think Buddhism tries to get them to feel in their heart different things once you address the thing that has to be addressed, right? You can't push it aside. It has to be hit head on. But that's why being under a good teacher helps, I would think, so that they can be guided and not have to do it all themselves. Is that what you do?
Yeah, I think when I think about what I do, I think about, I try to be a transparent channel for the wisdoms that I have been so fortunate to receive, which are very ancient. It's an ancient lineage. You mentioned Tibetan monks and Tibetan lineages, and that is where my own lineage is as well, in the Himalayan Tibetan realm. And so those techniques, and you know, really what Buddhism carries is a set of really profound, skillful methods or techniques for how to work with the inner constellation of our being in order to unlock our full potential for happiness, growth, compassion, kindness, and love. And so when I think about what I do, I'm trying just to be a purveyor of that stream of techniques and practices that have been so helpful for me in my own life, and just paying that forward as best I can. You know, and I used to think that we have to pay forward what we know in the same way that our teachers paid it forward. And I really did used to think that. And I used to measure up myself against, you know, these teachers who were primarily Tibetan from very very different background from myself. But in time, I've developed confidence that actually the Dharma, what we call the Dharma, which are these body of teachings and practices, needs to flow through many different vessels and many different contexts. And we're not going to look exactly like our teachers or teach like our teachers. We may be quite different from them. And you know, at times, trying to be a clear vessel is a challenge, because we all bring our own cultural baggage. We all bring our own personal baggage. When we teach, we're all human. So anyway, yeah.
It's interesting, because I feel like what I teach is maybe, if a concept was harder for me to understand, the trials of trying to understand that make me want to explain it better to the next person, you know? So my teachings are very, it's not even my teachings, my way of distributing information that I know go through these very specific, distinct words and ways. And I almost go like, we go back to kindergarten and then we build from there is how I do it, because that's how I learn. And that may not resonate with everybody, but that's just how I teach. And then you get who needs your teachings, right? You're going to get the people that resonate best with what you provide. That's why there's so many.
Wow.
So now you created this book that I believe is the next step of your teachings. It's called The Wakeful Body. And gosh, I have a lot of questions in here about this. So basically the way you broke it up was that you give a little bit about your history. Then you sort of talk about certain topics, and then you give certain meditation or different practices in this book per chapter, which I think is broken out extremely well. Like, I really like that format of how you provided that. And you really do delve pretty deep. So meaning a lot of yoga texts just say yoga means to yoke or join, you know, and it's not, it goes so much more beyond that into these concepts that can't really be understood because they can't be felt, touched, you know, looked at or measured even by anybody else, right? The measurement is your own, your own self. So I really do appreciate how much, without going into so many words, you just tackle it, say what you need to say, and you move on, and you do it in such a great way. So I appreciate this book quite a bit, actually, even as a reference guide to keep going back to. What was your thought into putting this together? Is that how you wanted to do it initially?
Yeah, I wanted to provide a roadmap for how to take the body as your guide, as your teacher, because ultimately, like you were saying, the arbiter of insight is our own experience, and the rubber meets the road, so to speak, through experience, and especially in a contemplative tradition where it's not so much about what we believe what we believe is not nearly as important as what we embody and what we learn through first person experience. That first person experience being contemplative introspection. And sometimes contemplative introspection coupled with certain movements and techniques and conceptual frameworks also. But yes, so the book as a roadmap to how to have experiences, how to stimulate experiences of contemplative introspection so that each person that reads the book becomes their own instructor, their own guru. And that to me is the direction that that my teachers took with me, and that I would love to pay forward to others, because ultimately that's the refuge. The refuge can be found in your own experience and the vessel that you create within your body and mind for awakening or for development and cultivation of compassion for the benefit of others also.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things Sadhguru says is our bodies are an accumulation of earth. So you've taken from Mother Earth, and when you die, you give it back. So if we keep taking and never kind of draw back down and in, it can be a problem. It's almost an off balance, if you will. So your kind of post title is Somatic Mindfulness is a Path to Freedom. What does somatic mean to you, that word?
Somatic means from the body, of the body, from the body and of the body. So a mindfulness that emerges from the body is somatic mindfulness. And that particular type of mindfulness is a mindfulness that's already happening right here and right now. Sometimes we think of mindfulness often and in the mindfulness world as something that has to be cultivated by a powerful and undistracted attention. And that when we develop that powerful and undistracted attention, the result is something that we would call mindfulness. And mindfulness is this ability to be present and focused in the moment in a relaxed way. And now, what I do in the book is I argue that yes, that's the case. That is a kind of mindfulness. That's an effortful mindfulness. But actually, we can access an effortless mindfulness that's already coming from and in the body itself. The body is already mindful. The mind is very distracted, but the body is just feeling, just breathing, just sensing. And when we enter that world of the body's sensual, present moment feeling awareness, that mindfulness and when we listen to that mindfulness, we become mindful without effort. Mm-hmm. So anyone can be mindful by just coming down and noticing that present moment aliveness of the body now, here and now.
Yeah, when I teach, I kind of backdoor into everything by we tackle the physical body because it you can feel it, you can touch it, you can see it, feel it, sense it, and it gives you immediate feedback. And it could be intense, but I feel like that is going to help then manage the brain and what's going on in the brain versus, so this is what I love about your book. meditation, it is so hard for people to just sit and meditate. No one's going to be able to just go from their life and then just sit down and everything's going to be clear and you're just going to focus on one spot and your concentration is eventually going to lead to meditation. That's just not how it works. And I love, and I actually got to this chapter last night, which was you have to move. You have to move the body. And so what you're saying is, I'm thinking, if I can recap, is that because the body's aware, you move the body, you get in the body, you sense the body, and then everything else becomes easier. This merge, this isn't, it doesn't work for the other things.
Yeah, movement is often, this is also partly why this book, why The Wakeful Body, because I've noticed this tendency to think that meditation is over here on one side and yoga is over here on the other side, or meditation is over here. This is one kind of activity. And then over here on the other side is movement. And these two things can't be done together. But actually, meditation in motion is completely possible. And that's what yoga is. Yeah. Yoga is, I'm in at its best. It is flow in which you are totally at one with your body. As you said, listening to its feedback, and experiencing wakefulness through feeling the aliveness of movement in the body. That is meditation. There's no difference between, as someone who has done a lot of still meditation, seated and focusing on the breath, or seated and focusing on a sensation in the body or a visualization with the mind or a mantra, whatever it is, the state that you get in, that flow state of seeing everything moving but not being thrown off by the movement, is totally analogous to when you're in your totally at one with your moving body. The movement is happening, but you lose that sense of I am moving, and it just becomes moving with no I and no goal. And when you're in that particular moment, that is the liberative moment. And we have those moments in seated meditation as well. So yeah, so part of the reason for that book too is to just point out there is no difference between this yoga thing over here and this meditation thing over here, that somehow in our culture we've made this division. But even in the Tibetan tradition, in the Himalayan tradition, these two things, seated meditation and yoga, are so intertwined. There are yoga practices within the Tibetan tradition that are considered to be just as liberative as sitting motionless, watching your mind. Same liberative quality. Same with Hindu yoga as well. This idea that there is meditation and there is yoga, if you're practicing within a Hindu tradition as well, these things are completely intertwined. And the word yoga actually means spiritual practice. It doesn't mean just movement practice.
Mm-hmm. So with Buddhists, they don't have the yamas, niyamas. You have something different, the Four Noble Truths, right?
Right.
That's your way. Okay.
Well, there are many, many, many lists. The Four Noble Truths is one, but there's so many lists. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you were talking about, I love that you addressed the nervous system too. Oh, that makes me so happy. I've been talking about the nervous system for years and how important it is to everyday functioning. And getting that under control, like there's no sense in trying to meditate, trying to do any complicated type pose if your nervous system is junk, because you will have a reaction, a bad one at that, most likely, if the nervous system isn't tamed. And so starting small, starting with little steps is great. There's nothing wrong with that because it takes the nervous system a long time to adapt. Well, it probably, you know, a couple of weeks it can adapt pretty well, but good long-lasting change is when we need to do more and more work. So one of the things that you said in the book, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it now, did you say that the subtle body, or is it prana and vayu, are the same thing? Is that what you were saying? Energy, so not the subtle body. So that energy and wind are the same?
It's two different Sanskrit words, but those two words are often used interchangeably to talk about the body's energy, vayu and prana. And vayu literally means wind, and it can mean in Sanskrit the outer wind, blow, you know, like the wind that I'm hearing blowing through the eaves of my house, and the wind of breath, inhaling and exhaling can be vayu, and prana more often is referring to the subtle energy, the subtle winds in the body, the subtle energy that is circulating through the body. But sometimes vayu is used interchangeably with prana to talk about those subtle winds.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
See, that was new to me. Yeah. I love learning stuff like this. So subtle energies are also considered prana?
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of just the main shushumna up the...
Yeah. The same term, prana, is often referring to those moving energy winds, not just the life force.
Keeping you to your body. It's also the
right
energies as well.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you had talked about Uma as the main channel. Is that like at the center of the shushumna?
It may be the same thing. So I think that I'm not trained in Hindu tradition, and these subtle body maps vary from tradition to tradition. Even within Buddhism, there's many maps, and they're not consistent. You just have to give up the wish to try to make them work together. They're just different maps, but the principle is the same. The principle of the maps is very similar, that awakening happens in the core of the body, and that you can work with the energies to bring them into the core of the body to stimulate an awakening experience, a kind of awakening from the bottom up, awakening from the body up. And I love just that principle, right? And I think when we get really stuck in the maps, and how they are, or, you know, do the winds go like in this particular channel, right up in this particular way? Then you'll look at another tradition. It'll have a slightly different map. And then you're like, wait, which map is correct? They're all skillful means for bringing us to the same place, the same principle, helping us to engage with and move our energies into the same general direction. Just the roadmap is slightly different from tradition to tradition.
Yes. Well, that makes sense. I mean, you could take it to the most basic level of how come triangle in Shivananda is different than the triangle in Ashtanga versus the triangle in Kundalini, you know, or Kriya Yoga. The Kriya Yoga triangle is very different.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read what you had said in this book. Is it okay if I read an excerpt? The subtle body is the subjective experience of the nervous system when observed within a deep state of meditative attention. It is not uncommon for us to go our entire lives and not notice the visceral all-over aliveness of the body, the feeling of our own sentience. Distracted by appearances outside and rumination within, we miss its quiet symphony. Which it is a symphony that's quiet because we don't hear it. But when you think about how our body is keeping us alive, there's chaos in there, but stillness. It's like, you know, blood is flowing, cells are dividing and dying, and all this whole process is happening all the time, and we're not aware of any of it. None of it. Isn't that sad?
Mm. And we could become more aware of it. Yeah, we aren't, Lisa, always from day to day aware of it. And we could become more aware of it. And that is the direction of, yeah, of the, could say, the yogic perspective, that we can listen to the body and listen to its vibratory aliveness to see what's happening. Yes, and when we slow down, I mean, we could do it in motion. Yes, absolutely, do it in motion. But even in motion, this notion of slowing down the fast-paced conceptual listening to that chatter, which is what we're mostly listening to, coming down from that chatter and noticing that underneath it, there's all of this incredible aliveness and energy that's like a vibratory field, always present. And like you said, also calm, because if we tune into that vibratory field, just like if we tune into space or openness in a room, like if I look at the space and the openness in this room, it's very different from looking at all the objects in the room. If we look at the vibratory aliveness of the body, instead of listening to all of our mental chatter, we notice that there is a lot of openness in the body and a lot of consistent, steady hum of energy in the body. Yeah. And when we notice that, it's incredibly calming and centering and balancing. Does this resonate with your practice, Lisa, of yoga?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, I feel like I have so much joy. It needs to like overspill, and I have to contain it, you know, to not off put people. Right. And I also, it's so sad to me that people use substances to block out these feelings. Because life can be overwhelming. And so there's a turn to other things. And it can be painful to shut those off if they don't want to feel within the body. You know, I took this course on the trauma, and they had talked about like there's the levels of trauma, but you don't just go from like level 6 to 1. You have to go level 6 to level 5 to level 4, 3, 2, and go back to 1. So who's going to want to be at a 6 and have to go through all those stages to get back? Because we just want to go back to level 1, right?
Right.
So it seems that cutting off, you know, the eating too much food and having too many substances and being around people too, you know, a lot of people want to just be around other people so they don't have to feel too, right? Just listening to other people or being and just outputting a lot. That's an addiction too, right? Like the extrovertedness.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I feel like feel the feels, but also like let it like go back to the true nature of this vibration that is what is. That's what's you, not your name, not your, you know,
right.
Your job. That is you. That's how I feel like the persona. So when I connect with people, I connect with more that aspect of subtle energy.
Yeah.
I feel like it's more attuned.
Mm. In Buddhist traditions, we call that Buddha nature. Buddha nature is the fundamental awakeness of each person, and everyone, we could say everyone is walking around as a Buddha, and we can choose to relate to the imbalance and the reactivity that we all display, or we could choose to sink down a little deeper and connect to this more to this wisdom self within each person that has a subtle body expression. We could choose to relate to that, as we would say in the tantric traditions, we could choose to be in relationship to the vajra body of each person, which is the wakeful body of each person, instead of all the disease and how that manifests even underlying that disease, there is a natural radiant radiant being, a being of light who is already wise, who is already resilient. And when we bring that kind of attention to a relationship, it changes how we are with each person.
It's a beautiful thing, and it's why going to a retreat center or being around people who are on a similar path just feels good. And they may not understand why, but just being in the presence of other people. You know, we had the monks at the time were doing tours. That's how I met them in the first place. And we had 9 monks stay at our house. So we have a pretty small ranch, but they took up so little space. You know, they're men. You would think 9 people in a small ranch with a family of 5, it would have been packed. But just being in their presence, everything was calm. They don't take up a ton of, they can kind of control their energy when they need to, where they're not outputting, you know, the way I do normally. And just were able to kind of hold their own space without taking up a lot of space. It was so interesting to watch their day to day. And I wish everyone had that type of experience to kind of see someone, they've been on the path since they were little kids.
And they've been in community since they were little kids and been in close-knit community. So they know how to enter into a context and fit into the environment more like water and less like rock. Or I'm so familiar with that kind of that very special quality that some of the monastics carry with them, that has to do with, I think partly it's the meditative practice. It's that they've been on a path of calming their winds, so to speak, but also because they know how to be in graceful relationship from being in such close-knit community, in often sharing a room or more than one person in their monastery or in their tents. If you know, Tibetans started off nomadic, and if you go there, they're all living together in these very small tents, so gracefully. It's very
so gracefully, yeah, inspiring. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I do want to go over this one part of the book, and there's so many questions that I could ask today, and we're going through so much time. Okay. One of the things that I do with my teaching, which I had watched a podcast on from a neurobiologist in California about how we change the pathways in our brain. And I realized this is what I'm doing, but I didn't have it in the order of it specifically like a scientific thing. And then you had it in your book. And I was like, cut it out. This is amazing. So the way he described it was, okay, so after 25, we don't really get new pathways, but you can take an existing pathway that might be a dirt road and make it into a paved road, make it into a double wide, right? Make it into a really strong road. The way to do it is to move, have enough focus that you don't feel bad if you, so say the focus is balancing on one leg. Let's just say it's that. And you fall onto the second leg, it's not a big deal. You've not lost a lot, but you have enough focus that you're on that one leg. And then you have parameters like stand on this one leg, look up at the sky, hold an object. Let's just say those are parameters. So you've got the parameters, you've got the focus, and this can be done with actual movement as well. And that's what strengthens the neural connections the most. So there's a part of your book that has these aspects that neuroscientist was talking about, you know, and he termed it in terms of play, like it's playful, right? You have some parameters, like a ball game. You don't, you know, you might care if you win or lose, but like, it's not do or die, and you enjoy it along the way. And there's a level of focus, right? You want to hit the ball, you want to get to base, you want to try not to get tagged out. And those aspects are what you had sort of in your book as another set of steps, which I thought was so interesting, because you do talk about, you know, we do want better pathways created, because we have to take out the old, the ones that don't serve us, and create these new ones. Did you want to talk more to this section of your book?
Sure. Yeah. So this section, I put in to just encourage practitioners, which is anyone that reads the book, could be anyone, to see exercise not as a to reframe exercise as a spiritual practice. And I think that when we if we're practitioners of meditation or of yoga or of any spiritual inclination, we may tend to think, okay, here's my spiritual practice over here, and now I need to go running, or now I need to hike, or now I need to swim, and that's over there, and that's just for my body and to stay in shape. And actually, exercise can be so much more than just staying in shape and just even just being healthy, although that's very important. Of course, we know exercise is the magic bullet for a long and healthy life, along with what we put in the body. But actually, exercise can be yoga. Exercise can be a liberative practice that draws us into the state of flow and even a state of non-duality. And so so what I was doing with this section of the book, which I call Body Sadhana, is making the point that whatever your exercise routine is, you can play, using your term that this neuroscientist used, you can play with that activity as an invitation to release the separation that we carry around with us between body and mind and between self and world. And in some parts of the book, I talk about this as somatic non-duality, that we can, in some ways, we're divided within ourselves, mind up here and body down here. And although that is where how we often are, we can actually learn to integrate body and mind completely. And that integrative experience is liberative. And it helps us transcend the sense of a small ego, just me, this idea of just me. And so I suggest doing that through 5 steps. Intention means setting your highest intention for the best outcome for your practice, which in this case is your exercise routine, but we're going to rename it as practice. For my liberative practice, I'm going to set an intention for this session of, for example, jogging. For this session, I'm going to set an intention. And then movement. I'm going to move my body and enter into the flow of that movement. Third, challenge. I engage in that movement until I reach an edge state. And the point of reaching the edge state is exertion. And something happens when we exert the body. I mean, I'm talking now from a spiritual perspective. We burn up a lot of the restless energy that is moving, and imbalanced energy that's moving through the body and through the mind. When we exert, we expend that energy, and it helps us relax, actually, helps us enter into a state of greater ease. It's like a great out-breath when we start to expend that energy. So challenge, and then focus, surrendering into the present moment, subtle body without distraction, which means to be so engaged in your activity of jogging that you lose the sense of me jogging
and you just become the activity. And when that happens, you experience something that we call in the yogic traditions, prana mind unity, a dissolving of the sense of separation between energy or prana and the one who is paying attention to the body or to the energy. When the subject dissolves into the prana, there is a complete sense of liberation. So that is the process that we can enact in exercise, making exercise a nirvana activity, if I may use that terminology.
Yes. Well, I know that through a lot of trainings and teachings that I've done outside of yoga, you know, with other anatomy teachers, things like that, pain science, you know, the thing that fixes almost everything is movement. It's like, well, what's going to help movement? What can help that movement? It's always comes back to move the body. It needs to be in a perpetual state of motion because it is. And then when it's well functioning and doing well, the sitting for meditation is so much easier because then you're making a choice with it.
Being is so much easier on the heels of doing. The doing facilitates the being. And there's something very profound about moving before you sit, and very, very beneficial. Because especially if you can do something a little bit vigorous, a little bit challenging, that really gets your prana flowing. Then when you sit, it's so vivid and so relaxed because you have expelled some of that restless energy. I think you can have a better meditation on the heels of motion for sure.
Now, one quick question. Are nadis and nerves the same thing? Are nadi pathways the same as nerve pathways?
I think that it's very similar. To say it's exactly the same, very similar, perhaps sometimes the same, but I step back from saying that because when we're creating a habit pathway, which is how I'm describing a nadi is a pathway in the body and mind, body mind, that carries impulses. So yes, like a nerve, but many other things other than the nervous system are involved in those pathways, including hormones, including the fluids and the liquids of the body that carry with them, are interdependent with the nervous system. So I think there's a number of systems in the body that could be aligned with this, with the concept of nadi, okay, as a pathway of habit that actually has many dimensions to it, not only the nervous system, but also the chemical system of the body, chemical systems of the body. And that's why I step back from saying it is just the nervous system. Right. But I think what I'm trying to do in the book, which I hadn't really myself encountered before in traditional materials, in traditional yogic materials, which I have my hands in, which are more written in Tibetan for practitioners of Tibetan yoga and for practitioners of Tibetan meditation, there's very little in there about the theory of what nadi actually is. There's more in there about maps of where the different habit patterns, or whatever you want to call it, travel, where the prana travels throughout the body. But I'm more interested in exploring what does nadi mean from a subjective, experiential perspective, and was trying to put that into language, that from a subjective experiential perspective, nadi are these pathways that stretch all throughout the body, They are pathways of habit and pathways of how we move and pathways of the sinews in our body. And so anything that is a pathway for the movement of energy, I'm stretching because I feel my nadis when I stretch, that sense of a pathway extending through the body. What is that from the subjective experience? So I use the term pathway for nadi in the book.
Yes. Well, there's so much goodness in there. I can't wait for people to read it. And I think you have a course that you're doing right now that's kind of going through chapters. I'm sure you'll do that again.
I'll do it at some point. Yeah. And there's just for people that, like, you can't join the course at this point this year because it's right. The registration is closed, but you can. I will be teaching a course on the wakeful body at Omega Institute in person in early June, I believe, or July. I'm not sure which. And I'll be teaching it at Kripalu, a course in Kripalu at the end of August in person on the wakeful body. So take a look if you're interested at those courses that are in person.
I'll try to link those for people.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate this so much. You're so generous. And I love that we are common New Englanders, both here in New Hampshire, with always just interesting weather, right?
So interesting in the spring.
As we talk about the Vayus, it is blowing abound.
Yes, it is. Never a dull moment in the spring.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so good to see you, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. I wanted to update you all on the studio. As of right now, when this podcast comes out, we will no longer be at the physical location of 44 Cedar Street. Please check out our website at ohanayoganh.com, as we will still be doing events, we will still be doing classes through Zoom, and we will keep you posted on our new location. This one will be very big, so be prepared for what's to come in the future, and I hope you all have the best day.